Hello and welcome to QS Cast. Each week we take a look at the big stories in Magic Finance and give you the story on what's worth buying and selling. If you're subscribed to Quiet Speculation's Insider Service, you're hearing this podcast on Wednesday. If you're not already signed up, you had to wait till Friday to hear this. If you're not familiar with the Insider Service, head on over to quietspeculation.com and you'll find out about all the ways we can help you pay less money to play Magic.
Everyone, and welcome back to the QS Cast. As we promised, Tarkan and I are trying to reconnect with some of the vendors that we talked to before the year ended. So we have a esteemed guest, Nathaniel from Card Hoarder and Isle of Cards. Nathaniel, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys.
Yeah, welcome back, Nathaniel.
What's up, Tarkan? You're back at least temporarily to a more normal time zone, so you're not killing me here, but.
That's right. We're doing an afternoon cast for once.
Yeah, this is pretty good. I think we want to just kind of continue where we left off, but to give just a little, I guess, precursor to what we're talking about. We have a docket of what we wanted to talk about with Nathaniel. Kind of go a little bit deeper into what we were talking about the first time. And just get at least your thoughts, Nathaniel, on some of the changes going on with Magic the Gathering Online, some of more specifics when it comes to Isle of Cards, your paper, business. So we will get into all of that, and I guess I will just kind of go from point to point, and then we will wrap it up the same way that we normally wrap it up, get your thoughts on some of the cards that you are trying to acquire, some cards that you like. So let's just jump right in. So this is part two, so let's. How was the last year for Isle of Cards, and specifically the final quarter? And do you feel, because we were kind of talking last cast, and I think Sigmund brought up some good points about maybe having a good outlook for 2017. Are you looking at 2017 positively?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely are, and I think my perspective as a pretty small vendor that is looking to grow is probably a little bit different than, say, a large vendor that is already large, where the growth isn't necessarily on the same trajectory. What I'm trying to figure out, or what we are trying to figure out with Isle, is what is our best approach to, fund the most growth? Because it's so fundamentally different than our main business in Magic Online, with like the delays, like the delay when you sell out and then you buy listed, how soon is it going to get here? As opposed to online, where, it's probably like an hour before we get it back in stock. The cards are so much more expensive, especially the really old stuff. Is it even worth getting into that? Is it, So, I mean, like a lot of, and I hope to actually like talk to you guys a bit about, from a speculator's perspective, what do you look for in a vendor? Do you typically send cards in quickly, or do you wait, or, there's lots of like little nuances that I think are really interesting. But as far as our outlook for 2017, we hope to, grow significantly, like double or triple in size. That's a pretty obviously ambitious goal. And every time there's big Magic Online updates, I'm like, we really need to grow our paper business here just to kind of hedge a little bit. We'll talk about that later too. But, it's one of the reasons we got into the paper side anyway. I think that one thing that we've kind of discovered is that even though we're small in terms of like the amount of inventory that we have and, number of employees, et cetera, I think we, have shown that our approach works really well. So it's kind of us just needing to figure out, refining our processes, but also just like, where should we invest our money as far as inventory goes? Like which, part of, legacy or vintage, is that even, something to consider? Just doing more modern and standard or frontier, if you will. So that's kind of where we are as far as like, how do we grow? I haven't necessarily answered that question yet, but, the plan is for us to double or triple in 2017.
So if, wow. I guess if you're looking back at 2016 through the year, you know, we spoke in late October, early November. So in the last quarter, how was 2016? How was that last quarter? And then now moving into 2017, like did you guys hit all your goals for 2016? Was the last quarter really good? And now are you guys looking to, you guys set higher benchmarks? Obviously, you know, with whatever detail you can provide us, but
sure.
How was sort of last year comped against what you guys are doing this year? How did it sort of play out for you?
Yeah, I mean, last year is definitely like, we're still pretty new. I think I will always consider us to be a new vendor, regardless of how old we get. but you know, it's still kind of just refining processes. So, you know, I mentioned that kind of lag time, which I haven't quite solved yet. We've implemented an incentive for people to send in something early. So if we get it within 7 days, we'll offer 2% extra on top of what we normally pay. So we didn't actually change our buy prices at all. We just literally add 2%. So, I mean, like that I think has worked out really well. But it's those sorts of things that I think we need to figure out to really grow. And so the numbers were good as far as sales go. But I think it didn't quite hit my, I mean, we came reasonably close to my year end goals, but we didn't quite get there. And I think a lot of it is that lag time and just, you know, not having stock, because since we're pretty small as far as vendors go, and we're trying to operate on, you know, a just in time approach, if you will, in terms of how much inventory we're holding. You know, being out is bad when someone comes to the site and, all right, I want to buy this deck, but you're missing three of the key cards. You know, I don't think that's all right, I'll buy the rest of the deck and then come back for the other. You know, it's more like, well, I'll just try a different vendor. So I think solving those issues, either by holding more inventory or, you know, developing the relationships that we need to develop, you know, in a different way, I think are how we will expand to what I want to be this year. But the numbers we saw in terms of the last quarter were, you know, kind of just below what I was hoping for, and certainly in line with expectations. And, you know, there was no like the sky is falling sort of thing. But as I mentioned, you know, we're kind of like pretty small vendor growing. So it's, you know, I'm not sure how useful that perspective is from a grand scheme.
So have you set, like, you know, as we move into 2017, then is there anything, you know, is there anything on the horizon that, you know, people who use your site or that buy less, are there any big things coming that you can either talk about or not talk about, or any changes that people should kind of be looking out for, some interesting things that are going to happen in 2017 for Isle or even Cardboard, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, well, for Isle, I was thinking about this, like a lot of the stuff that we're looking at for, you know, growth and expansion on the sales side, I'm not sure how relevant it is to your audience per se, but we've, you know, we're doing more custom tokens. We're hiring artists, you know, like legitimate artists to do these tokens, and we do giveaways with those. And just like branding stuff that I think, you know, really hits home with a lot of our customer base. And I think solving the buy listing stuff, because I listened to your podcast with Card Kingdom, and I think they're probably one of the biggest buy listers. And so it was pretty interesting hearing their perspective. And obviously their inventory and size is significantly larger than us. But, you know, ultimately we need to figure out what we need to do to get cards back in quickly. And so I think ultimately it's going to be developing relationships either with specific larger speculators or, you know, maybe other stores and dealers or LGSs to get the types of cards that we are constantly out of certain things. And so I've played around a bit. I mean, I think it's probably going to be shrinking our margins a little bit more, like, you know, paying like 85% of our sales price or something like that when we're straight up out of something. And then thinking of more ways to get cards in quickly. And I think you mentioned, or I heard mentioned on the Card Kingdom podcast, that there was like, they used to do 14 day and now they just switched it to 7 because it's something like the reality of the market. Right. But I mean, it's definitely pretty tough. I mean, it's hard because USPS, I'm sure you guys know, it's like sometimes they'll just, like something just gets delayed for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I know that.
I mean, customers don't really like to hear that, of course, but I mean, there's just nothing that can be done because they're the cheapest by a lot. So you kind of have to use them. But, you know, my thought was to kind of encourage speculators to buy list with us. Aside from the normal, like, you know, don't be a jerk as far as like downgrading and dinging people on very minor points and stuff like that. But, you know, us being able to buy higher quantities, since I think typically you'll work in larger quantities. So on like staples, you know, being able to buy 50 copies or 80 copies or whatever some of the larger stores tend to do. And then figuring out whatever way it is to get people to get them to us more quickly. And I really like the approach of incentivizing that as opposed to penalizing not doing it. But I think that the general rule, at least for the industry, is to penalize for not doing it.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about the upping the quantity count. Is that something that you guys are in the process of implementing? Because I know that, you know, in the past, you know, because I love buy listening to you guys. I think you guys are great. And obviously your customer service is top notch. But I did notice that sometimes, you know, you guys had that quantity cap. Is that something that you're in 2017, you're looking at maybe, you know, raising that cap or maybe eliminating it? You know, you guys can send, in if you have 50 copies of whatever uncommon, you know, you can go ahead and ship it in. Or is that something that you're just sort of in the, like, you're just kind of looking at it right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the forefront of my brain as far as things we need to do, both because we want to be able to accommodate, you know, people that have larger quantities and need to unload larger quantities.
Yeah.
But also just because, like I mentioned, that we're constantly out of certain things. And, you know, we get it in and then it sells in like 2 days, you know, or one day, yeah, or a couple hours. So it's just, you know, I don't know what the right answer is. I'm not sure we could ever buy just like whatever people wanted to send. That always scares me. I mean, I do other stores do that?
I don't think they'd just buy anything.
No, I mean, they no, they don't buy anything, but they will, you know, they'll still offer bulk prices on stuff. Like, I don't know if that's something that you were looking into, but normally, I mean, if it's not on their main buy list, they will still offer you the default bulk price, because I guess they figure, you know, we just buy for bulk, and then who knows, one day we sell it, right?
So you mean like bulk rates? Are you talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Like 10 cents a rare or whatever it is, and like 25 cents a mythic.
I think we did start buying bulk.
Okay.
At the end of last year. I haven't really publicized it that much because we get most of our buy lists through a PO box, and when you're buy listing or when you're bulking commons and uncommons, you can't ship it to a PO box. So I've been trying to figure that part out. I think I have it. I just haven't had a chance to kind of like announce it, if you will. And of course, like, buying bulk has its own risks, especially when it comes to buying from, say, your audience, because, you know, if you're buy listing bulk, you kind of want to get at least some good stuff in there to make it worth the time to go through it, right? Whereas a lot of people that kind of do it as a hobby or living have gone through and taken everything worth anything out. Right. So, I mean, there's always like kind of a give and take there, but you know, the way our buy list works right now is we have like a quantity target. So that's why like the numbers are constantly changing in terms of like what we're buying, because as soon as someone buys a card from us, it will instantly be on the buy list that we're buying that card. And you know, if we don't want to have more than say 50 copies of X or 100, then that's why like the numbers are small, at least in comparison. I think that a lot of other stores just kind of don't have the same. If you use Crystal Commerce, I don't think you can do that the same way. I think it's just like you're buy listing this card or you are not. And like the quantities are always like, I look at some competitor sites and it's like, oh, we'll buy 2,000. I'm like, would they really buy 2,000 copies of that card?
I think the only site that I mean, Tarkan, you and I had magic.cards on, and they will mostly buy like anything. And I mean, obviously, there's parameters in place, but they're like literally the only place that I've seen that will buy like your like Dark Ritual from, you know, whatever for 10 cents or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
They've also, just to comment on that too, they're moving towards similar to Star City, where you know, they're putting in an approval process over 20, I think it's 24, 25 copies.
Sure.
So, I mean, they're still very cognizant of like, okay, if somebody's going to send us 200 of this random common that we're buying, like, we just need to make sure that that's still okay. But Yeah, like they're one similar to Star City. Like if for like 90% of their buys, like if you've got 200 copies of something on their list, they'll generally take it, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think that if you want to do that as a vendor, you either have to have a lot of working capital, which, you know, I mean, like hundreds of thousands of dollars, I would think you would need to do that. Or have the approach, which I think most vendors have, which is that you just can quickly unload them on TCG Player, which, you, I mean, if you underprice something there, it'll be gone, you know, instantly. Whereas, like, so we don't actually sell through TCG Player, so we don't have that option per se. I mean, obviously, we could just do it if we wanted to. But I think that requires a lot more kind of manpower, and ultimately, my goal is to kind of get everything automatic. Or as automatic as it can be. Obviously, you still need to pack up orders and grade cards and stuff. But, you know, in terms of like pricing and how much quantity we're buying, you know, I'd like to get us to the point where it kind of all happens automatically, like it does on Magic Online, you know, because we're coming from that and we know how that works. And obviously, it's really great. And whether or not it's feasible in the paper world, I don't know. But so, I mean, a lot of the stuff we're doing now is just trying to collect more data and then implement small changes in the back end of our site so I can identify stuff like, all right, this one looks like it's moving a lot or this one doesn't. So you'd asked the question earlier, like, are we starting to do that? I've started to increase our target quantities on stuff so that we will buy more. But, you know, for modern stuff, like our target quantities are still in like the 20 to 30 range. You know, it's not like a ton of copies of particular things. And I mean, ultimately, like I could see like a sort of a relationship builder sort of thing getting us there, either partnering with somebody that has that kind of capital or, you know, I don't know. I haven't figured it all out just yet. But I mean, it still strikes me as like how much money there is in paper Magic and how much like cash on hand some of these big stores must have to operate with to be able to do the Grand Prix buys and stuff that they do. So I'm not sure we ever want to kind of take that approach, but I do want to find solutions for, say, your audience or speculators where we can accommodate, at least to a reasonable degree, you know, buying larger quantities. And I don't know if that's like giving certain people exceptions, like, hey, you're, you know, we'll mark your account like special account and you can buy less to us above our target point. You know, like, I mean, there's the nice thing about our size is customs. We can, anything we can think of, you know, we could conceivably program into it. It's just a matter of finding out what works for everybody and like getting the feedback from people like you guys for me to understand what would work for both sides.
Right. So just to kind of piggyback on what Tarkan was saying, and I'm sure these two things will go hand in hand as we talk about it, but I know that's kind of one change that you're working on. Are there any other bigger changes that you're looking to make for IOLA cards specifically? Because I know you mentioned the fact that you're really looking at this side of it now in lieu of all the big changes to MTGO, which we will get to. So again, I know it goes hand in hand, but I know the buy list is like one little step. Is there anything like, is it, what's your goal? Like, what's the end goal? Where do you envision IOLA cards? Like, is it going to have a, you know, brick and mortar presence at some point, or where do you see it heading?
I wouldn't expect us to have a brick and mortar presence unless we get acquired by a brick and mortar store. You know what I mean? Like, I run brick and mortar stores, not LGSs, but stores, and it is not easy. So there's a lot of headaches associated with it. There's a lot of investment and that needs to go into it that, in my opinion, does not bring in the return on investment that you could otherwise get. Just so, I mean, I think our goal is to just be an online vendor unless some sort of partnership arose where, you know, I'm trying to think of how to say it without sounding like super conceited, but, you know, I think technologically our site and operations work really well. And so, you know, if someone were to kind of be interested in that side of things, I could see a partnership or something evolving. But absent that, I would not expect us to have a brick and mortar presence. But, you know, my hope is for us to grow to the point where we have the systems in place to make everything automatic. And I don't know what that is, but it would certainly have to be many millions of dollars in sales a year. So, you know, far away from where we are. But, you know, ultimately, I think that would be the best approach in terms of what is missing in the industry, because we don't really want to just be another vendor, right? I mean, it's just what's really the point of that, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah. Now, well, I know.
Not sure I answered your question.
But... No. I get it. I mean, I can understand that you're looking at the website first and, like, getting that into a spot that you can, I guess, get it to a point that you want it to be, at least more than what it is now, in terms of if you're still just really looking at paper a little bit more in lieu of everything that's going on. I know you mentioned the buy list, and I think that's, like, the first out of all the vendors to, like, add an extra incentive to send in the cards. Do you find yourself acquiring a lot of cards from, I guess, the people like us, like the middle people that, you know, just dump a lot of stuff onto you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know for sure, because I don't really get into, like, a huge discussion with them. But I mean, right. A lot of our buy listers are very clearly repeat customers, and I see them on the QS forums. I mean, so I assume that they are speculators. But I think one of the other things, like, we often have stores selling desks, because we'll buy list, like, we don't really keep bulk on hand. So, and we happen to just sell, like, commons, like, random commons and uncommons. So there are people that, if they want to go through their cards and sort and sell us a common for 7 cents that they're otherwise not going to sell, then, you know, I think we've kind of found a sweet spot for people that like that.
Right.
Even though we are buying, like, huge quantities, but, you know, if we buy 10 or 20 copies of something you would never otherwise sell, you know, it seems to be kind of in people's wheelhouse. So ultimately, like, I think we need to get more, I used to, like, from the staples perspective, or stuff that we just can't keep in stock, like, finding those relationships with the speculators that have large investments in various things and are looking to unload them in some way or another. And, you know, finding what is going to incentivize you, say, to sell us 50 copies of some card. You know what I mean?
Right.
So are you finding that you're
go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Chad. Are you finding that you're, so it sounds like the challenge is you getting inventory more so than moving the inventory. Is that kind of
what you're, I think it's kind of both. I've heard, in terms of people that use TCG Player, I think the clear difficulty is getting cards. Because with TCG Player, although you're not, I mean, the problem I have with TCG Player is aside from the fees and the other stuff with Direct that seem to be pretty difficult, you don't really develop your own brand. So you are very beholden to the company with which you are selling. And you saw that happen with eBay many, many years ago. And they would just, like, continuously screw their sellers until finally it was just, like, a breaking point, right? But so, I mean, so TCG Player is in a very, very powerful position. And, you know, you can almost effectively move unlimited inventory through it. So the vendors that focus on that sort of business model, I think their big difficulty is buying cards in quantities with which they can just, like, churn effectively and do large volume. Right. So, I mean, we're trying to, like, do the dream, which is, you know, more difficult, which is to, like, grow. But at the same time, you know, not just come and say with $1 million, say, all right, we're just going to buy all this inventory. And, you know, we're going to start going to the GPs. We're going to start doing all this. The effectively the existing business model that I think every vet or most vendors are on. So we're trying to do something a little bit different. But yeah, it's a little bit of a kind of a cat and mouse game in terms of having the inventory to sell and, you know, not investing too much in inventory. So the buy list and sales need to kind of, as we grow, stay relatively close. And we've done that. But, you know, I think something gets left on the table when you are sometimes out of cards that people want, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Just one more thing before we move on again. Is it reasonable? Because this is just, like, kind of an observation I had. And, like, I know you're kind of getting the site into a spot that you know, you're trying to improve on that front. I've noticed, and is this just because of, I guess, not having as much attention to this to aisle, but, you know, I even notice, like, pre-orders, you know, sometimes it even seems like a little lag behind updating the cards on that front. Is that just another general change that you feel on that front, like trying to just get the inventory where you need to be, and even like when you want to order, you know, offer pre-orders as they, you know, as kind of being like on the forefront on that?
I mean, one of the reasons why there's some, at least some delay, is I don't really know what to price stuff at. You know,
fair enough.
And I don't want to risk, you know, we don't really pre-sell enough that it would, you know, we're not Star City where they are seemingly pre-selling, you know, 6,200, 300 mythics of, you know, each mythic. You know, we're certainly not at that point yet. I do want to focus on that. But, you know, that pricing, evaluating cards is not my particular specialty. And, you know, we don't really have this massive staff of like pros where we can be like, what do you guys think? And then you price. I mean, I have no idea how they do it, but, you know, I tend to kind of look at a couple of the bigger stores and then say, all right, that seems reasonable. All right, we're going to be a little bit less or more. But I mean, I kind of need a baseline. But, you know, even still, like we'll pre-sell like 20 of each mythic, which is, you know, what, like 10, 15 cases, give or take. So the goal is to definitely expand that, because I feel like I have a much better handle on that, having been through a couple cycles. We were going to double that for Ether Revolt, but for a variety of reasons I won't get into, we just decided to like wait till the next set and deal with it then.
Fair enough.
So, you know, for, is it Amonkhet? Is that how you pronounce the next set?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, I would expect to, you know, at least double what we pre-sale and try to be more on top of it. The other thing is, like, I enter the cards in, like, so most vendors, not Star City, obviously, but most vendors will use Crystal Commerce, and Crystal Commerce just updates those and then everybody gets them, right? So for us, like, I have to put the card into the database. So if, you know, once a full spoiler comes out, for example, I'm kind of like,
right.
200 cards to put in, like, I don't really want to spend my weekend on that. So it's so that's why, like, you'll often see it kind of stop around, like, I get all the mythics in, I got everything worth anything, but, like, you know, the lesser, like, uncommons and commons, I typically will just let it go. But I mean, we'll kind of refine that process and probably automate it more, or at least automate more of it as we go and kind of expand. But it does, I would agree, it seems like a prudent thing to do and something that we plan on for the next set, and to just hopefully, like, you know, double. Yeah, I don't know if we would ever get to the point of Star City, because I just envision so many people like opening boxes and it being really, really cumbersome to do. Like, they must have a humongous team working on that. It must be insane to see.
Oh yeah,
yeah, absolutely. All right, so to shift gears here, and again, I think this all kind of goes hand in hand. We got to talk about it. We have Nathaniel. We need to dive into the recent Moto changes and the announcement from the president, Chris Cox. What do you make of all this? I mean, I know the last time we talked about this, you know, you said that, you know, you do have to make business changes. You are kind of have to adapt yourself. Is there like a final straw breaking point for you, or are you getting like legitimately, you know, are you kind of getting concerned? Yeah. I mean, where are we going on this?
I've a lot of people, including our employees, were asking me about it. It's definitely concerning. And, you know, from a business standpoint, like my opinion on Magic Online has and will, just by necessity, always will be, this can end tomorrow. And, you know, that's kind of the risk. I mean, it's one of the very few games where you can even use bots. You know, I think bots have done a lot for the game, but, you know, others would argue that they only exist because, you know, WotC couldn't program in that functionality themselves like they do in many other games. So, that's just one of very many approaches that could just utterly destroy our business, you know, overnight almost. I think that the biggest nightmare scenario, I think, is the least likely to happen, which is that our business is destroyed and the value of everyone's collection is also destroyed. I do think that's a risk, based on, you know, what we've seen from the announcement and the discussion about Digital Next and sort of the the crumbs that they've left us to kind of speculate with. I think that's a possibility. But I'm of the personal opinion that if they did that, if they did something like we're gonna just shut down Magic Online and we're gonna go to a monthly subscription where everybody has access to every card, I think that would virtually destroy their entire business, including paper. So I kind of sit back on the notion that no company that makes this much money would do that. But so that's kind of like my saving grace in terms of like value of collection. There's a lot of stuff that they can do that really hurts the value of the collection. So I think that is probably a more likely scenario. And I think another more likely scenario is that it's just they do something that makes it so that you don't have the secondary market in the same way, meaning that it's all peer-to-peer or whatever, it's automatic in the system, so that, you know, places like us just wouldn't need to exist or would not be able to charge a premium or whatever, you know, kind of argument you want to make. And that's if they get their ducks in a row and they really like put out a phenomenal project, which, you know, they have not done over many attempts. But, you know, they seem to be putting the pieces in place to sort of get to that point. So interestingly, I have not seen a panic sell-off here, which I had initially expected. We saw that we see that once a year for Magic Online. We saw it with Play Points. We saw it with Treasure Chests more recently, where, you know, you get panic sales, you get people like selling out, you get, you know, 20% price drops across the board. I didn't really see that. We've kind of had, you know, the normal amount of people selling out of their collection. That's not to say that, you know, there isn't a lot of churn, because there is. We buy a lot of collections, but I didn't see that same like huge spike that we saw in these other instances, which was a little bit surprising to me, because I do think that these changes bring a lot of uncertainty to the future of Magic Online. And even more to my surprise, WotC has not provided any sort of comfort whatsoever about that.
And I think that's a very, very interesting point to make, because I feel like the changes were presented in a way to make them seem like they're going to be very positive. And I think that I don't want to call it spin, PR, whatever you want to say, but I think that they're painting a picture that, hey guys, this is all going to be, I think people have these high expectations that we're finally getting the Magic Online 2.0 that everyone is hoping we would have had for years. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, I feel like maybe people are feeling like, okay, like I've got a little bit more confidence. Let's see what happens. And so let me hold on to my, that's at least the sense that I'm getting, you know, from my perspective.
Yeah. I mean, well, I've always said that if we had a version of Magic, like a software version that is what it could and should be, I would be very, very wealthy, you know? Right. If that were so, there is certainly, yes, there's risk, but there's also, you know, really big upside. If they're able to, you know, keep this business model, which frankly I think is the right business model. I you know, you hear people say they need to switch to the Hearthstone, and clearly they're trying to mimic it in various ways. But I think that they have the business model that Hearthstone envies. You know, the spend per player and the amount they make per player is just massive compared to Hearthstone. Of course, Hearthstone has tens of millions of players. So, I mean, it's certainly a completely different business model, but I think that WotC has the better business model in terms of actual profit. Certainly not revenue, and certainly not, you know, exposure and number of people watching their events and then that sort of thing.
Right.
But I think that they have the ideal business model. Whether or not, you know, Chris Cox and the other new people coming in see it that way, and the shareholders see it that way, I mean, that's, you know, I think a completely different story. But if they were to make that, if they were to make, you know, Magic Online V5, that is the dream, where they can run, you know, Grand Prix online, they can do all this Premier Play stuff, and it looks great, it's great to watch, you know, I think that it would be an explosion in growth for the game. And, you know, for our business, assuming that something didn't prohibit us from operating as we do now. So there's upside too, was my point. It's not just downside risk. I think there's upside risk too.
So what about the...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Jess. No, please, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, I think that's a clear way to come across that, Nathaniel. And I kind of expected you, you know, you're a level-headed guy. I mean, you have the podcast of your own, and you guys talk about this, and I mean, I think that's a narrative that a lot of people don't seem to understand is, I mean, it's just like any other digital asset, right? Like, it's any other digital asset that we've seen over the years where you're investing in this and knowing full well you're not getting anything out of it, and it could just disappear tomorrow. I mean, so...
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with the statement that they don't owe it to us, because I strongly believe the opposite. Because I think they've sold this game and they've sold this product with the understanding that that is what will happen. They, whether or not, you know, obviously if you read the terms of service, and, you know, you, which you agree to every time you log in, you know, WotC has a very strong legal team, as I'm sure you both know. So whether or not that holds up in the court of law is a completely separate discussion. But I think that if you've sold something for 15 or whatever, 16 years it's been, and then you pull the rug out from under people because Hearthstone came into existence and it's doing really well, when they are very clearly still doing very well themselves, Magic Online, I think that's why I think it would utterly destroy the game, period. Because I don't think that I think their game relies too much on the trust of the community in terms of what are they going to reprint, what are they going to develop, are they going to, you know, respect the reserve list. There's a lot of like those questions in paper that ultimately you have to just rely on the company to do the right thing, right? And so if they make a very clear signal that they have no interest in keeping the I don't want to call it a promise, but like, you know, keeping, you know, what they sold to you and respecting that that was done, if they show no interest in that, like, are you really going to trust them not to, say, reprint Black Lotus because it's going to make them a bunch of money in the short, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
So I definitely disagree with the notion that they don't owe it to us. I think they probably at least think that they have put themselves in a position where they legally do not have to provide anything to anybody. But I think that would be extremely short-sighted from a business perspective. And even if they do something which utterly wrecks everything, they'll try to do something that compensates people in small ways. Whether or not one will consider that to be sufficient, I think will be another question. Right, like for example, if they go to a rental model, let's just say hypothetically, they say, all right, for every ticket every 10 tickets you own, you get a free month. They could say that. But they're like, all right, great. I'll have, you know, free digital next for the next 180,000 years. Like, great. Or whatever. For like some of the dealers, you know. Yeah. But I still operate, at least in my mindset, like, yes, this could be, you know, this could become nothing tomorrow, which is true for Magic, right? I mean, they could just make several bad sets in a row and kill the game, hypothetically. Right. So...
Yeah, but there's always a divide on that line. Yes, it's dead, like, quote-unquote dead, but does it really ever truly die if people can just break out their cards and play a game of Commander or something like that? Like, it's not dead in the sense of they could shut down MTGO tomorrow and there's not a thing you could do about it. So, you know, there's always that kind of divide there of, you know, digital assets and just physical assets. I mean...
Yeah, that's true, but... You know, you're right that you can still play with the cards and paper, but let's be honest. If they stop making the game, you know, the cards are going to be worth very little.
Well, yeah,
You ever play that game Star Wars CCG?
Yeah.
It's a great example because those cards were, you know, they had comparable values to, you know, standard Magic cards, standard legal Magic cards. And that game was awesome. It was such a good game. And they stopped, and, you know, it's super cheap now. I mean, it's still, like, collectible in some way, but you can get everything that they made for wicked cheap, so.
Right. Well, I get, exactly right. Like in that sense... No, go ahead, Targa.
I think one would like to think that after 20, almost 25 years of building... I mean, the livelihoods of so many... I mean, there's such an industry that has been built around all of this that... It's almost like I think it's just too detrimental across the board for them to even make moves that would cripple everything. Like I highly doubt there's a scenario whereby everything crumbles overnight. Now, is there a slow burn death that could happen? Absolutely. But given the size and given the level of the secondary market that exists, I don't foresee a future where everything just overnight it's just apocalypse.
I agree. I don't think it's ever going to be an overnight scenario. Sure. But the slow burn is definitely something that is out there. What I've told people that are concerned about it is, you know, invest what you feel you can lose. You know what I mean? And, you know, I don't think it's going to die tomorrow. I definitely agree with that sentiment. But there's definitely some risk there. So, you know what you're getting yourself into. And if you're comfortable, you know, having a $10,000 Magic Online collection, then great. If, you know, you're really counting on that $10,000, I would probably pare down some just to hedge against it. You know, it's the same thing as – I think it's the same thing as paper, because there's lots of things that they could do that would be very detrimental to particular card values or whatever. So you are accepting that risk when you, you know, make a spec on something like a reserve list. You're assuming they aren't going to break their promise on the reserve list or their whatever legal obligation, depending on your perspective. But that doesn't mean they won't do it, you know?
Yeah. Keeping all that in mind and kind of shifting back into, you know, finance a little bit, is it your preference to keep card hoarder Nathaniel? Like, is this all kind of going in the way? Like, what would they have to do to keep you on board? You know, if they don't necessarily make Magic Digital Next, like, vendor-friendly, do you then shift gears completely to Isle of Cards? Because I know you alluded to that, but would you have preference to keep the, you know, card hoarder over Isle, or would you have liked to keep both, or was there even just a decision that you were going to make down the road to kind of pick one anyway?
I don't think there's any scenario where I would be, like, you know, we're working towards getting rid of one and focusing on the other.
Gotcha.
I think
okay.
They kind of go hand in hand. I mean, we will do card hoarder as long as it's economically feasible to do so.
okay.
You know, because it's the dream. Like, you know, having something in the Magic world where you can make a living from it is where I've always wanted to be. Even, you know, I'm an entrepreneur and I own other businesses too. But, you know, ultimately, like, I love this game. I love the community. I love everything about it. So if I can make my living from it, like, yeah, I'm gonna hang on to that until WotC pries it out of my cold dead fingers.
What would you recommend to the listeners of the podcast to approach, I guess, Magic in the financial sense and Magic investing for this coming year? Like, do you feel that it's becoming a little more optimistic? Do you feel that we're kind of still in a stagnation phase, or have you, is there something that you're looking forward to, especially going into the new year, that you can be optimistic about and tell our listeners to, like, how would you recommend to approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, let's break it down between paper and Magic Online, because I think they are pretty significantly different from a investing standpoint. So which do you want to talk about first?
You can do MTG. Go with MTG.
Magic Online?
Yeah.
One thing I've noticed with Magic Online in the last, I would say even 6 months, is that getting into and out of large positions has proven to be increasingly difficult without moving prices in a significant way. And I think some of the reasons for that, the MTGO library bots seem to, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but they seem to be sharing information in some way that labels a Magic Online account as a speculator, and then you are given prices which are not, like, are you guys familiar with Magic Online at all?
I don't really use it all that much, no.
Okay. So they have a website. I'm sorry, Tarkin, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just have base level knowledge.
Base level, okay. So there's a website called MTGO Wiki Price, which is effectively every bot that is using MTGO library software, which is one of, probably, I guess in a certain way, the only commercially available to the public bot software. So if you are coming in and you want to own a bot on Magic Online, you would have to use that software unless you know somebody else. There were hundreds and hundreds of bots. They kind of go in and out. Many are fly by night as a result, because people don't kind of get into it and don't understand what they're doing and lose a bunch of money and then quit. But all those bots sort of are, in theory, independent chains where, you know, it'd be like each of them is an LGS. So that's how it used to be. So, you know, every store, say hundreds of stores, need to have every card in Magic Online, right? So, you know, you could get into and out of positions very quickly because you would just go to the various, you know, I'm going to go to this spot, this spot, this spot, this spot, this spot. And, you know, I just picked up, you know, in 10, 30, you know, 30 minutes, say, I just picked up 200 copies of this card I wanted to spec on. Recently, it seems like the MTGO wiki price bots are sharing information to either outright block or show fake prices or higher prices to people that are speculating. And I don't know how they define that. And I don't have any definitive proof, but when I've tried to pick up positions on these bots, it's like all of a sudden the numbers are just like totally wrong on their website. And they're offering prices that are, 40% below or, above market. So it's hard to get into lots of positions with those bots or to sell a large position with those bots. In addition, there's another bot software company, and they all seem to share a restriction. So it's a bunch of different people, and they share restrictions on a 24-hour four of period. So you can sell four copies of this card or buy four copies of this card, but it's across, 15 chains. And you don't really know that they're related. And again, I don't know the exact C's about that, or if I just ran into some bad luck myself, but that's kind of been my impression. So a number of, independently operated chains that aren't sharing information or sharing prices or whatever, it makes it very difficult to unload large positions, because if, say, you're going to sell to us or you're going to sell to GoatBots, you sell four, all right, price is the same. You sell four more, all right, the price has changed now, because, the algorithm's trying to figure out, what's happening with this card? Is this card spiking? Or, there's no it's not spiking, it's just this person unloading a bunch of cards. That's not a thing. So whereas the Magic Online market used to be super liquid, you could get into and out of hundreds of cards really easily, I don't think that is there anymore. So that makes it significantly more difficult to speculate. The second thing I'll say that I've noticed about Magic Online speculating is the prices move incredibly rapidly, which says to me there is a load of people speculating on Magic Online. Let me give you an example. So this past weekend, I thought Saheeli was going to do really well. So I bought, 60 copies, say, with a plan to sell in like a week or two. And I don't really, despite our name card holder, I don't really do it that frequently. I probably do a couple a year. So I think I bought them around 11 tickets. And then, I don't know, since you guys don't really follow Magic Online, there is a school of thought in the speculating world that you just go and buy any, the first thing that comes on camera, you're buying. Like anything that's on camera that first day that seems to be doing interesting or fun things, you're buying that. And then you're like, it's basically a pump and dump almost from what I've seen. So
pretty Saheeli, much. Yeah.
Yeah. So Saheeli on day, and it can happen on Magic Online, right? Because you're getting the cards and you're immediately unloading them. You can't really do it in paper. But so Saheeli went from 11 tickets, it got up to like 15, say, over that course of that day. And then, it wasn't presented the same way on camera on day two. I still think it had a big presence. And then in the top eight, all three of the combo decks, the Healy combo decks, lost in the first round. And then the black green decks or whatever ended up winning. Those cards all spiked. And and then Saheeli went back down to like eight, like it halved in price. So I don't think that price movement happens unless it's speculators. I don't think that players are like watching the coverage and saying, oh, this deck looks really fun. And then on day two, they're like, oh, maybe not.
Right.
So you need to, if you want to get into the Magic Online speculation game, you better be literally on your computer while you're holding positions, because the prices move that quickly. And, you can see that, I don't want to say the panic, but if it's all speculators, right, no one wants to be the one that's holding their copies when the price goes back down. So it's kind of like I feel like you're in a cat and mouse game against other speculators on Magic Online, at least in the known time periods where these rapid changes are happening. So bannings, around the BNR changes, the week before, you'll start seeing, Jace the Mind Sculptors go up and, people kind of betting on, big changes to happen. You definitely need to be on your toes, and you need to try to seek out new ways to load up and unload your positions, which I think is significantly more difficult than it used to be.
Right. So in that sense, you feel mostly like you're up against a lot of especially in those times, you know you're up against a lot of competition. Whereas in the paper side, yeah, that's definitely going on, but there's also players doing it too. And I'm sure it does happen to some degree on MTGO. But, you know, a player will look at a card, it's like, oh, that's fun, let me buy four. And then the speculator, quote unquote, is like, oh, that looks fun, let me buy like 20. So. Right.
Or let me buy 100 or 1,000.
Right, let me buy 100, right. So
because TCG Player is basically what enables that, right? If TCG Player did not exist in the way it does exist, where most stores are using it and have to use it, you would not be able to pick up that many copies that easily. I mean, I don't actually do it, so I'm just kind of working on like secondhand knowledge. But isn't it true that you can buy hundreds of copies on TCG Player at times for certain cards?
Well,
usually not from a single vendor.
Yeah, no, not from a single vendor.
No, of course not. Of course, but in a single order, though, right?
Sure. I mean, yeah.
So, that's ultimately what enables that.
Right. But the problem is that while you're doing that, I guess it's kind of like you will find this happen on MTGO. As you're doing that and loading up your cart, people buy the cards that are in your cart. So it's like it's hard to amass. Unless one vendor has like 25 and another vendor has like 25, it's hard to amass 100 in like a split second.
Right.
So.
Right.
But you can check out with like any cards, like it doesn't matter.
Right. Right. There's no restrictions. Whereas of course, the single store, like say for us, we have a 4-up restriction because we only have 30 copies, whatever. Like, I don't want to sell you 30 copies and then have no inventory for a week for the other customers. So it's one thing if you come in and buy four and this guy buys four, this guy buys four, this guy, then we sold out kind of somewhat legitimately. And like, I don't care if the card spiked, whatever, like we sold it too cheap, but at least, 12 customers are happy now because they got it, as opposed to like one customer, boom, everything's gone. Now we're all sad for a week.
How about for paper then? You definitely have – it's a very interesting perspective for online, but what do you think for paper moving into this next
– I'm not sure my perspective is going to be as interesting for paper. One thing that I think is interesting, and maybe you guys can correct me if my thinking is incorrect, but I think that the standard ban and the message that Sam Stauder put out after, as well as the modern ban, I think indicate that a sort of more ready willingness to ban cards and to kind of make the format healthier, if you will. And I think that alone, the additional BNR announcement 5 weeks after the Pro Tour as well, like more frequent bannings, I think brings up a lot more opportunity from a speculator standpoint. It's terrible for vendors, at least in some way. I don't think it's terrible for vendors in that you're going to get bought out and like kind of, like the speculators are going to buy you out or sell you a bunch of stuff that just got banned really quickly. And, every store, of course, has their own approach to whether or not they're willing to take a loss on that or not. Most of the big vendors will just take the loss, and that's just kind of the cost of doing business. But it does seem to me like that raises a lot of opportunity on the speculators side of things to both be on top of those things and pull the trigger first on TCG Player and on any of these vendors, know all the vendors available, go to their sites. Like, we're not on TCG Player, so sometimes a card will spike and we won't get bought out because we don't, we're not big enough for people to check. So it's, I think it gives the people more willing to put the time in and be on top of those announcements, it gives them a lot of opportunity. And on the other side of the coin, we came into this weekend really not knowing much. It's basically a completely new standard for all intents and purposes. So, if you are a good card evaluator, I think it's a great environment for you as well, because, even now, like we're pre-Pro Tour, and we'll talk about specs at the end, but it's like, what do you think is going to come out on the Pro Tour and be on top? Because if you guess right, you are going to make a lot of money. Whereas if Copter and Emrakul were still here, I think obviously those opportunities still exist because there's a lot of powerful stuff in Aether Revolt. But, now we're just like, it's brand new decks, basically. Huge, huge opportunity for speculators when there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what's being banned. It does make it riskier to hold positions, but to like get into new positions and make the actual speculation, I think that those opportunities are more prevalent than we've had in recent memory.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, I think Chaz and I always talk about how we generally have a philosophy of get it and move it. And I think that is nowhere more prevalent than in standard. And I think you're absolutely right, Nathaniel. I mean, I think with these new changes, you get stuff in. If it pops, you move it and move on. And I think you're absolutely right. I think I was initially a little concerned with the bans because I knew a lot of players felt kind of burnt, and obviously people holding copters were burnt. But yeah, I mean, look how many more. I think it's a net positive for both. Actually, I think for both vendors and speculators.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that, you know, the more decks that have the opportunity to be played and people enjoy, and, you know, that just means more cards that go up in value, and a more interesting standard hopefully means more players playing standard, which just overall just means more money moving around. So while it sucks if you had Emrakul and Copter in your inventory, you also now have Saheelis, and you have, you know, the Ballista and all these other things that pop due to new decks in a healthier format. So, no, I actually think it ends up being a net positive pretty much across the board.
Well, the people it's bad for are players, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, but, well, yes, for that one hit, right? But now if the information's out there and everyone knows, look, if something becomes abusive, be prepared because it might get banned. You know, yeah, it sucked the first time because nobody knew it was coming. And I did. I was a little frustrated to see that from a player perspective, but I think it's now they sort of set the standard that, listen, you know, if things are getting out of control, we have the ability to come in and ban when we need to. So I think people are now prepared for that.
Right. I mean, it may be the case. But my own personal impression of this was it was signaling a sort of almost ready willingness to, you know, it's great for WotC too, right? Because it makes standard exciting again, because nobody knows what's going on. Whereas like before, people were pretty upset with standard because, I mean, that's honestly like you designed some cards that were too powerful. It's what you did. And, you know, they don't make mistakes like that too frequently, but they know the next, 2 years of sets or something. So, you know, I think they've shown that they're going to push powerful cards. And if they're going to do that, they're going to have to be more active banning. And you're right that if they're going to signal that is a thing, then players will know sort of ahead of time. But the only way that doesn't become super, super sad for players that, like, you know, some players don't have, you know, $300 to keep dropping, you know, keep dropping on a new standard set, a standard deck. Yeah. You know, if they were under the impression that this deck is going to be viable and then all of a sudden it isn't, you know, are those prices going to be depressed? Are prices in general going to go down? You know, because that's bad for probably WotC. It's got to be bad for WotC, I would think, at least in terms of the initial open, because the prices won't be as high. You know, I'm not sure it's that bad for vendors, but, you know, I think there's a lot of unintended consequences that come out of it. It's pretty hard to kind of hash out exactly what will go down. But I do think that frequent bannings, while they are great for speculating, are potentially damaging long term for the player base that, you know, isn't as vocal about it, or just, you know, does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Yeah, there's a contingent of players that either not to say they're not plugged in, but they're more casual standard players and they like playing their Emrakul deck, and all of a sudden out of nowhere the deck's banned, the card's worthless, you know, they invest well. So sure, I mean, I don't know. I think that there's a business benefit to them in that, you know, if you want to completely approach it from a cynical point of view, you can say, well, now, you know, they can make OP cards, sell a bunch, ban it, sell a bunch because now we have a new deck, new decks that pop up. You know, there's that perspective. Yeah. And you know, maybe that's partially a motivation there. I'm not going to assume that, but, you know, who really knows? But I mean, I think that overall, I certainly think standard looks more interesting now. I think that card value, I mean, I think that this was kind of a benefit to Aether Revolt and standard in general. I mean, I think the ban ended up kind of working out. Yeah, I talked to some players who felt a little burned, but overall standard looks a little bit more interesting. So it's tough, right?
There's no doubt it looks more interesting. I mean, you know, I don't think there's anybody saying that. Yeah. Or maybe there is. I mean, maybe I just haven't heard it. But I mean, I think I would probably tend to lean more towards the cynical side of things, that WotC is kind of doing things to increase their growth. Yeah. Because I think that the growth has slowed and there's some panicked executives out there, which, you know, that doesn't mean they won't do them in a way that is, you know, net positive for the game, but it does have the tendency to be dangerous. And I think I mentioned it last time I was on the cast, is like, we're in a period where it looks like Watsy's going to start doing money grabs and, you know, trying to, you know, do things that rock the boat a little bit and like get the short-term gains that the executives are graded on, not the long-term success of the game that the players graded on. And, you know, that has the potential to be dangerous, especially say in the context of, you know, MTGO and Digital Next, etc.
Well, since you go there, I'm kind of curious. Well, and Chaz, just want to throw this out there real quick. Since you kind of go to that more general comment about the health of the game, so as we talk about speculating and finance moving into 2017, overall, given from 2016, the last quarter, everything's happening, what's your perspective on the health of the game and the health of investing in Magic overall?
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that the game is, to use your words, thriving. You know, I don't think that the growth that we have seen in the last whatever 5 years is really a sustainable thing forever. You know, and I am one that is personally of the opinion that I don't think we can have as many Magic players as you do Hearthstone players, just because the game is much more complicated. So it just doesn't have that as wide an appeal for people willing to put in the time to learn the game, to start playing it or watch it or whatever, find some way to enjoy it. So I think the game is very healthy, whether or not WotC sees it that way, because of, you know, what I mentioned about, you know, how are, you know, executives graded in terms of, you know, if you make $200 million this year and then $200 million next year, it's not like, wow, we're doing really well, we made $200 million. It's, what is going on here? We haven't grown. You know, it's, why didn't we make $220 million? So it's hard to know exactly how that's going to go. If they're going to seek that additional growth from like making a Magic Online MMO or whatever it was that they had suggested, that kind of doesn't affect the status quo and more tries to build the brand bigger, like Star Wars has done or Avengers, like basically what Disney is doing with all the properties, the IP that they acquired, trying to like monetize that IP. I think that's fine. I don't think it affects things. If they start doing like things that end up being like, in hindsight, like pretty silly, like pushing cards too far and having to ban things all the time, or, you know, doing very aggressive reprinting, which is it Yu-Gi-Oh or Pokemon? I don't know which one of the two gets into that sort of cycle, that kind of affects people pretty negatively. I think that would be dangerous. So I still think there's some uncertainty in terms of, you know, what are they going to do to try to solve the quote unquote growth problem, and whether or not you see that as a problem, I suppose, depends on your perspective. But, you know, notwithstanding that, I think that we're in a great position. You know, Aether Revolt looks good. Amonkhet, you know, in terms of the lore, I think it's supposed to be sort of Egyptian, ancient Egyptian sort of leaning. You know, that's going to be, I think that the flavor, which they do really well, I think will work well there. So, you know, I think they'll continue to make very good Magic sets and good limited sets, which they've done. Like Kaladesh, I thought was great. Shadows, I thought was really good. I didn't care that much for Eldritch Moon, but I don't think they need home runs every set. But, you know, a few home runs a year, one or two, I think would be good. But, you know, the amount of releases that there have been has been excessive, in my opinion. There's some worrying things, but generally speaking, the game and kind of the perspective, I think, is good. As far as investing, I think that, you know, I would lean more towards your two philosophy of kind of get in, get out. You know, we're not necessarily in a let's hold and see sort of investing environment. Right. Unless you're willing to take a very large amount of risk, because they're printing so many supplemental sets now. I think Conspiracy, they had a bunch of reprints, which I think was a little surprising to some, certainly to me. Whether or not it was surprising to others, I suppose, is up in the air. You know, Inventions, I guess, are kind of reprints, but they're still like highly collectible. So it's really tough to say, but I think it's getting in a having to repeat that is getting to a sort of dangerous waters. So I think there's Oh, and then they did those treasure chests for paper, right? I forget what they were called. Standard Showdown, maybe?
Oh, yeah, the Standard Showdown packs, yep.
I did not hear good things about that, but I think it suggests, again, an environment where, you know, reprints are very likely, and therefore holding positions is dangerous. So I think you need to be more active than passive, though you can certainly continue to make bets on, say, like, I don't think they're ever going to touch the reserve list. Let's do this. Or, you know what? I think Frontier is going to be a thing. I'm going to buy those. You know, I think there are some long-term plays you can make, but they need to be sort of, I think, well thought out and reasoned. And, you know, you might be wrong, you might be wrong. You might be wrong, you might be right. but
we got you.
Yeah. So I think those are sort of the plays that I would be making. And then, you know, there it is an environment where speculating, I think, is something that you can do frequently because of the, you know, when they announced the Modern Masters, you know, obviously it's pretty dangerous to hold Modern staples right now because you don't know what's going to be reprinted in Modern Masters. And that's coming out real soon, I think, like 2 months or something. But, you know, once XYZ didn't get reprinted, like, you know, then you can kind of hop on that train or you can...
yep.
I suppose you can speculate, like, I don't think Tarmogoyf is going to get reprinted, and I think the bannings are you know, make it more attractive than it was, so I'm going to hop on that. You know, those are higher risk speculations, but, you know, the environment for speculation, I think, is ripe this year.
Fair enough, and I think I agree with you ultimately, Nathaniel, that I think Wizards will push it to the limit, like, what's working, like the masterpieces and then the showdown stuff and all that stuff, and then they'll try something else, because you're absolutely right, it gets to the dangerous is a good word, but like just redundant after a while. Like, how many times can you print masterpieces after a while? It's like where people are just kind of like, oh, you know, that's cool, but I'm not really into it anymore.
It's like from the vault, like it was super cool and now it's like, who cares?
Right. It's like anthologies. Oh, that's cool. I get all this stuff again. But like, it was cool the first time, and now there's like a million of them. So I think they will try different things. But I'm, you know, Tarkan and I don't, you know, Sigmund was on, who also writes for the website. You know, we were talking, and you know, I think there are general, and you did outline a lot of stuff. So there are generally things to look forward to, and like you said, you can do. You can do this stuff successfully. I think it hinges on some things that weren't necessarily as prevalent before, right? Like, you talked a lot about the get in, get out kind of thing, where you don't want to really be playing that waiting game and seeing what is and what's getting reprinted, what's not getting reprinted. You also talked a little bit about if you're really good at card evaluation, you will succeed on that front because, you know, again, I don't know the future of how they will handle bannings, but as it stands right now, when you are banning stuff and you're creating basically an entire new standard format, and I think you use that term very well, those open up a lot of different opportunities, not just for people that are, I guess, speculating, but for vendors too. I mean, they start selling all these cards that normally it's like, well, a whole set's going to come out. Does it beat Embercool? No. Okay, well, you just move on, and we bear it. Right? Like, right.
And for what it's worth, I know that it's a pretty sour topic, I think, from what I've seen, possibly. But, you know, Frontier, I think, ultimately will succeed because vendors want it.
Right.
They want to sell those cards.
Yeah, and we've talked about it. I mean, we try not to talk about, and again, not to, like, bash anything, but we don't know what it looks like in the future, because obviously Wizards will look at something like Frontier and want to get their hands on it kind of thing. So you don't really know where that ends up. But, I mean, you enjoy it now. And I think that's kind of still the hesitation even from, like, well, vendors are selling their cards, which is great, even right now. But even still, it's like, do I pick up specifically everything for this format? Like, what does it look like after Wizards gets their hands on it? That's kind of still where I am on that.
It's a high-risk investment, but I'm just saying, like, it's – I mean, I think whether or not Frontier is what succeeds or becomes a format, like it will happen as some iteration of that idea, right? Something in between Modern and Standard. But by definition, like, Modern is just getting too powerful for, you know, it's getting too close to Legacy for the likes of some. And then ultimately, like, whether you think this is 3 years from now or next year or whatever, it's going to be, I think there's no question it's going to be a thing. And so whether or not you want to play that long game and try to spec on some of that stuff, you know, the opportunity is there, but, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, you know, if you are looking at speculating or you are a speculator, stick with what you are good at. If you're good at that sort of speculation, then do it. If you're good at, you know, card evaluation, great. You know, if you're good at just being online at the right time, then, you know, that's fine too. So at the end of the day, it's like, just like with kind of any job, if you will, it's like, do what you're good at and what you have had success with and kind of stick with that.
Well said. All right. So let's move into the last kind of segment. Tarkan, you know, and Nathaniel, you're used to this now. So let's look through some stuff that has, you know, the interest of, you know, we look at the last week. So, and just some stuff that we are looking to acquire or what we think is a good purchase right now. So are there any that you specifically pointed out, Tarkan?
Yeah. So the first one, and I think we're going to end up picking EDH and casual cards for the foreseeable future because those just seem to be just kicking so much behind. But Cedrus the Trader King, which is...
Oh, you stole mine, man.
Was that yours?
No, that's a good one. That's a good one. That's a good one. I'll let you keep going.
So Chaz and I are both recommending Cedrus the Trader King. Chaz will say that you saw it first. But,
no, it's fine.
This thing has Chaz, we can talk about it. Single printing, Shards of Alara. It's old. It's a zombie. It's an EDH commander. Has really interesting interactions with your graveyard. Gives all your creatures on Earth. I mean, the buy-in is $2 and it looks like around $250. That seems way too low. Seems like it has a lot of room for growth. And actually, when we look up the card, I'm going to take a quick look and see what the trajectory is just to give everybody a sense. Looks like the card has been, I mean, not super flat. Actually, it's just been going up. So, yeah, over the past, it looks like the past several years, it's only been an upward trajectory. It's kind of flatlined now at around the $3 mark, $2.50 where it's at. I think this card has only a continued upward trajectory. That's my first one. The other one that I really like is Chance Encounter, which is a coin flip card that ends up, once you have enough successful coin flips, you win the game. I've heard rumblings that coin flipping is becoming kind of a trendy, popular thing, and I think the old school and in casual circles. So that's another old one with only a single printing that I really liked. It's around $3 or $4, I think. And so those are my more casual Eternal picks. As far as standard, I am looking at the lands. I'm looking at Botanical Sanctum in particular. It was featured in the four color Saheeli deck. It's around $2-3. If that hits at the Pro Tour, I think you're looking at double up there. It could be about a $6 land. And I still like Aethersphere Harvester. I know there's only so much money to go around in Aether Revolt, but Aethersphere Harvester I think is still sitting in around. You can get them under $4. You know, it was a three of in the black green decks. But let me confirm that.
It was a three of in one of them. I don't know which player it was, but.
Yeah, and then it was in sideboard and a couple of other decks that did well at the top 8 at the SCG Open. So I still think there's room for Aethersphere Harvester.
Yeah, and before I rope in Nathaniel, just really quickly, just to touch on some of the other stuff that we did talk about. Retract is up pretty big. You know, Sigmund did talk about that card. Another one, you know, obviously we're seeing a lot of stuff from the SCG Columbus, like in reactionary stuff. So Authority of the Consoles, Verdus, Gear Hulk, Walking Ballista. Yep. Just seems like all of that stuff that we were mentioning. Safi, Eric's daughter, up pretty big, 155% from the last week. Expropriate, it's pretty good in a multiplayer setting. I'm not going to lie, but I did not foresee this card jumping from like $4 to, I think it's in around $15 now, somewhere around there. So it's pretty interesting. And then Azuri also is now kind of doubled up from the $2 mark, sitting around $4 and some change. So yeah, Nathaniel, what are some stuff you are looking at, my friend?
Well, I gotta say, I wish I was on last week because I would have said Saheeli. But granted, that was for Magic Online and not for paper, which I don't think the paper price even moved much.
Don't worry, I got you on that one. I was talking about that like months ago.
Oh yeah, nice. And the other one that I was looking at this is specifically for Magic Online, was Spellqueller. I really like the card, and I think it's going to be in some decks. And so that is one that I would consider. I think the paper price is, it doesn't leave as much upside, I don't think, as Magic Online. I think it's around 4 tickets online, and paper is, what, like 7 or 8, something like that. So, you know, those were what I was looking at before this weekend. Before I get into what I think I would look at for the Pro Tour, I'm going to say one that that might annoy Chaz, but I'm going to say it anyway. I debated. But Gonti Aetherheart, I think, has super great casual appeal. And I know that the Saffron Olive is going to make a good deck out of it. And I know, Chaz, I know it annoys you that people spec based on what Saffron does.
Oh, man.
however, obviously it's a testament to how popular he is, of course, at least originally.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that paired with his other favorite card, which is still standard legal, right? Part the Water Veil?
Yes, that is still standard legal.
I think there's a deck there that will be very fun to play. So I just think that from a fun factor, that card is good. But from a finance factor, I think if and when Seth did it, I think that would certainly cause a spike. But whether or not it's a card in its own right, I think is hard to say. But Seth's really good at, you know, building those decks to make them at least playable. And he had a deck with, or a couple decks with Part the Water Veil that I had a blast playing. So, you know, that's one card that we cannot keep in stock, by the way, is Part the Water Veil for whatever reason.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, right? Strange, right? But anyway.
Well, to be fair, Nathaniel, just real quick, I mean, Chaz and I were talking about Gonti's Aetherheart. I mean, these are the kind of casual cards that at the very least you pick them up for long-term pickups and they double up over time. I mean, anything that says take an extra turn in paper is going to creep up over time. I mean, it's an absolute hit. You definitely want to be picking those up just even for long-term.
And the only reason I like stuff like that for the long-term is because, again, it's energy-based. Part the Water Veil has Awaken on it. So stuff like that doesn't normally get – is not on the – like stepping up to the plate to get reprinted immediately.
Right.
So that does have some appeal. As far as you know me too well, I don't even know. Honestly, I confess, I guess on this podcast, because it's the first time I really, it was even brought up on a podcast. I don't know why it bothers me so much. It's just kind of weird. I don't know. I guess it's because it's just unfortunate.
I can understand it. I understand why it does. But I think you're just look, because every time I see it happen, I see your
reaction. I'm just like, oh man,
like, why is this a thing? This shouldn't exist. But it's like, I mean, it's obviously Goldfish has grown to a staggering level at this point.
Yeah,
like, you know, the traffic and Seth's own following is just really high. But like, he is good at what he does. You know, it's not just like random. So I think it's more of like a celebration of how popular it's become. But ultimately, it's the consequence of anything. Like if Pauper became like the main format, like it's not going to be a cheap format at that point, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
Like it sort of takes away what it's supposed to be, but there's such a huge demand for that level, like for those budget decks and those, like the decks that are actually fun. You know, not everyone's a spike. You know, I want to take extra turns 6 times in a row. You know what I mean? Like, so that market is so big and it's so underserved that, you know, when there are people that are good at it, they become very popular. Like I'm blanking on his name. Travis Wu was another one.
Yep.
Or the, you know, the Wu effect or whatever they called it. Because it's a huge market. So, you know, I jokingly say I'm not solely picking it because I think Saffron Olive is going to make a deck about it. But he is absolutely going to make a deck on that card. I think it's just guaranteed.
And if you, even if you did, I mean, like, this is just my kind of thing where, you know, again, like you said, and I think we both mentioned this on the podcast last time when you were on, is that if it works for you, it works for you. I mean, yeah, I get it. I understand why it happens. And I guess I've come to terms with the fact that, like, if people legitimately still want to play it, they're going to keep buying the cards and it will legitimately go up. And if not, I mean, people kind of know that these things happen. And if they want to play the deck, they just have to wait. So
right, yeah. I mean, certainly for Magic Online,
right,
generally speaking, if you wait 2 or 3 weeks, like the cards are back where they started. You know, so if you are a avid player of that, and I doubt you have that many people listening to this cast that do, but hypothetically, you know, I always just say, look, just wait 3 weeks. You'll be able to pick up the deck at the original price. That's not 100% of the time, because there are actual real decks sometimes, or just they're so cheap that it's like, you know, like sometimes there's like a five ticket deck, and some people are just like, whatever, I'll just buy it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I did want to mention also for this card, like I think that I was watching the coverage and they were talking about perhaps throwing Marvel into a deck. Some of these decks just happen to have a bunch of energy. You know, I think that maybe you could make the same argument for this card, for Gaunt to Aetherheart, because, you know, if you constantly have like 10 energy, you know, being able to cast this and like get another turn or two out of it would be incredibly powerful in the right deck. So I think there's some level of chance that it is in the sideboard or some way in as a one of or two of in a deck. But as you guys mentioned, the casual appeal of this card, I think, is really high.
Yeah, and the fact that it does give you two energy. So it's like if you are playing it, it gives you the two energy to kind of finish off the energy you may have already built up, and then you just pop it immediately and take a turn. So it is a pretty cool, interesting card at the very least.
Yeah. So as far as the Pro Tour is concerned, I'm not sure how much of an upside there is because there was a lot of spiking going on during the Columbus event, but I think that I saw enough from Control that I'm pretty convinced that there is going to be a top tier Control deck at the Pro Tour. I don't know what the color combinations are going to be. I mean, certainly blue will be in it. But you know, if it's blue red or blue black or even maybe blue white, I think blue white is the least likely. But I think that, you know, there's certainly some potential for speculation there. You know, Torrential Gearhulk, I think, is the clear winner there. And obviously that just spiked significantly. So it's a less sexy pick. But I think it has the potential to get up to 30 if there's a Control deck that is a top tier deck, because I think that will be a four of without question.
I bet. Yeah, I agree with you.
Disallow as well. I think I heard chatter that it was just kind of bonkers. So, you know, the added ability to stifle, I think, makes it super strong. I think it was Jim Davis that was saying that he stifled a Westvale Abbey activation, which is like,
wow,
which is like a 6-for-1 or something. So, you know, I think that I personally hate playing against Control decks, but I think we've not had a strong one in a while. And I think the bannings I think in particular the banning of Copter really makes it a more likely scenario. And I do think that they printed some more powerful Control-ish stuff like Disallow and certainly the Gearhulk as well. And then I think Kalidus is still, I mean, all these suggestions are like, they're on the expensive side, but you know, I think a 50% upside is still possible for them. But Kalidus, I think, is around 20-ish, but you know, I can see that going back up because, you know, if the opposite side of the coin is going to be these aggro decks, you know, the Lifelink and the, was it the Metalwork Colossus deck that,
yes.
You know, there's not a lot of graveyard interaction, so Kalidus is graveyard interaction in a way. I think, you know, if black is the paired color for the top tier Control deck, I think that's a decent bet. And then some of the lands that go with it, if you're betting on black, I think both Choked Estuary and Sunken Hollow are great pickups. They're not like super cheap, but I think there's a lot of upside. Fumarole is another one. It's one of the rare cards that you see with a significantly higher price online than paper. I think it was like 11 or 12 tickets versus, I think, $7 in paper right now. But you don't see that too frequently. So that piqued my interest. I would, you know, probably do a little bit more because it's a $7 land. I don't know how much the upside is. The blue-red lands are not cheap. So the upside might not be great. But, you know, like I said, I think a 50% upside would be, if I was doing it, I would be looking for 50% and then out. And then if it, you know, if it goes more, then great. I don't care. You know, I'm just going to lock in that rate. Modern seems really risky to me. But if you are very good at evaluating cards, it's wide open. So, but with the added risk of the Modern Masters set coming up very soon. I don't know when the next SCG Modern event is. Do you guys happen to know?
I think they run one like congruently with the standard. They just don't put it on camera, but they
do. Are you talking about the classics?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically what you have to look forward to. I don't know if there's a big modern tournament. I would have to double check.
Yeah, it would have to be an open, right? Because they don't.
Yes.
They don't do pro tours anymore.
if anyone does know the date, then they can comment. But I don't know offhand when the next like big modern open is.
Yeah, I mean, I only mention it because I think that there's a lot of opportunity there. But you know, the Modern Masters coming up so soon in the year as well makes it very risky to do. But, you know, there's definitely some opportunity there. But I don't have any specific suggestions. I just don't know Modern well enough to make any.
There's a Modern tournament at this upcoming Open. I mean, this
is Richmond?
Richmond is standard Open, but there's a Modern Classic side by side.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the Classics are good. Like, they give you some idea, I think. But you know, it not being the main event, I think, does affect how much it tells you. Not to say that, you know, a lot of players, good players playing them, but, I think that, you know, it being a modern open would give you a lot more information than the classics do. And I guess the last spec that I would have for paper, and I don't know when the right time is. For me, I would just be probably doing it now and over time, but Aether Hub is a great card. And it's got some pretty broad appeal. I think the question mark with it is every deck in standard plays it. It's really difficult to evaluate as a result, but it's just everywhere. So I think that potentially gives you some potential short-term upside as well, though you might, I suppose, make the argument that, like, if it's in every deck now, how's it going to go up? But, I mean, even some of, like, the control decks, I think if you get more people interested in standard, then that goes up. And I think if you get a control deck to be good, as well as an aggro deck and a combo deck, I think you've kind of got you got the right recipe for the right players. So I still like it as a short-term pickup as well. That's another one that we are having a hard time keeping in stock. It's just, it sells in every deck, so it's just constantly out of stock. But I think picking that up for now in the short term and for the long term, it just as a Tendo replacement or, you know, legacy vintage, you know, playable card, depending on, you know, how things sort of shake out. I think it's a great long term play. So it'd be my long term pick. I figured I'd give you one of those too.
Awesome. I think when it comes to Modern, we did see a couple of interesting things. I think there was an IQ and then the Classic. And you're right, like, they're not huge, but it does give a nice little insight. So we talked about this on the Goldfish cast, that there was someone who played Cheerios to a fifth place finish in an IQ.
What is Cheerios?
The Pure Steel Paladin, like the combo deck with Retract.
Okay.
And then they, like, combo off and grape shot you for, like, a million.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, so with the printing of SRAM, so there's eight of them now, apparently. Like, the eight Pure Steel Paladin effects.
Yes. Because of the goblin guy?
Yeah.
It's the dwarf.
That was a dwarf, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that was, and apparently the pilot was known for either creating or was part of Lantern Control becoming a big thing.
Wow.
So there's some upside there. But I mean, all the cards really spiked already. Yeah, there was upside there. But I also saw, so we didn't really know if this was going to be, and I kind of picked Safi as a combo piece to the new card, the Renegade Rallier. And it did actually show up in the Modern Classic. Someone took it was called Abzan Chord, if you want to look it up on Star City Games. The Renegade Rallier and the interaction between Safi did show up, so.
Nice.
I guess that it did end up being a thing. And I have to say, the uncommons still in Aether Revolt are really good.
Oh, they're awesome.
Renegade Rallier and the Constrictor still, I think, are great. I think Constrictor is now trending up towards a dollar, where, you know, over the weekend you could have been having them for a quarter. But they are trending up towards a dollar. I mean, they're just great cards.
Do you find it hard to win on those types of speculations, like a quarter card?
I mean, if you're selling them for, you know, a dollar plus shipping, it's pretty good. Even after the fees.
Actually, those tend to be buyless plays, Nathaniel, and they actually
can be
very successful. They're very, very successful.
Gotcha.
If you buy those things at especially if you're getting them at, I mean, quarters for these, like, staple uncommons that move to a dollar and they buy list for 60 cents, I mean, you make a killing.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you happen to, you know, come across a buy list where I'm giving you like 60 winding constrictors in the next few days, that's
that's okay. I'm fine with that. If we need them, then I want you to ship them to me. And if there's something that we can change on our site to make it more palatable to sell them to us, then I want to know what it is, whether it's you guys or listeners, because I'm dead serious. But I do think that getting large quantities like that shipped to us quickly is a path to victory for our business. So
there you go. There it is. All right. I think with that,
what are your picks,
Chad? Oh, what? Oh, I have to actually pick cards.
You gotta give some picks, man.
All right. Since you're not going to do it, I have to talk about a reserve list card. Unfortunately, I don't like doing it, but
yes.
I have to run it by, I don't know if anyone knows about this, but, you know, a while back, it was City in a Bottle. City in a Bottle. Not Bottle of Suleiman. I got that one wrong. City in a Bottle spiked to, like, some crazy number, and it stayed there, too. You could still, like, $40.
Yeah.
And I look at the card. I might be butchering the card's name. Golgothian Silex?
Yep.
And I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be a $40 card, but it's just another, like, crazy hate card in that format. So it just seems a little weird to me that City in a Bottle, although it is a better card, I would think overall, is like $40, and like this card's six or like five, yeah. Is a little weird to me. Although I guess you would have to run it by old school players, how much Antiquities is, you know, in comparison to Arabian Nights cards. So maybe this doesn't get to the $40 rate, but I mean, at $5, who knows? I'm not saying go out and buy a million of them, but.
Can you buy them for awesome?
I don't even think you can. I don't even think there's a million of them.
that just adds fuel to the fire for the speculation.
No, but I have to point it out. But yeah, I really like Cedrus the Trader King. I don't know why. This is not a card I wanted to open back when I was opening Alara, but every Cedrus the Trader King could have been an Elspeth Knight Errant. But I guess over the course of 4 years, it has just continued to creep up.
Go up.
So I really like that. I also like...
Do you like anything in Standard?
I don't know if there's anything else in Standard to really talk about. I mean, we talked about, like, literally everything last cast. I mean, Torrential Gear Hulk, Verdurous Gear Hulk, Walking Ballista, Rishkar.
Rishkar, yep.
I mean, so, like, literally everything we talked about has increased. I still think there's, and I don't know how many applications there would be in Standard, but there is the, I saw the card, the Glint Sleeve Siphoner.
Yeah.
And I sent a, you know, well, now that, you know, that's over, I sent an insider email and we were talking about it. That card just seemed crazy to me, but I don't know.
Is that the Dark Confidant? The new, like,
yeah,
new...
that is the Dark. I mean, yeah. Two energy is like, it gives you an energy, and two energies, I mean, you could literally just go like you said, Aether Hub. And then you just go black, and you have two energy already.
Yep.
So it's not that hard to make two energy, especially with a constrictor out. I don't know. I don't know how much upside it has, but it was like a 50 cent, like 75 cent card. I think that could. I think it's trending towards over a dollar now. So I think the ship has kind of sailed on that. I don't know where the ceiling is. I can't see this being more than like a $3 card.
Yeah.
$3 to $4 card max. So. I don't know. I don't really have anything for Standard. Sorry, folks. But, yeah, Cedrus. And I do like Sigmund's choice of – and I'm not really – I guess I'm stealing it at this point, but Heartwood Storyteller. It's a one-off printing and Future Sight. It's like that those weird cards that, like, help everybody. So I don't know really what the cap is on that, but it's just an interesting card.
Yeah.
So that's all I got for you. I don't really have much for you this week, honestly.
Since you brought a reserve list, I feel compelled to throw one out there as well.
Oh, yeah, okay. Right, you feel...
I do. You've totally compelled
me. I don't have to pry you to talk about it. You want to talk about it.
I actually think your pick is actually really smart because, like you said, if sitting in a bottle can be $40, then why can't this be at least $15, which is more than a double up? So, I mean, yeah, I think you, if you're gonna play that thing, I don't know if it's played in old school. I'm assuming somewhere it is, but you might as well just get it now. The other one is Corpse Dance, which is actually under $3, about $3 or $4, and it's a reserveless card that again just does so much shenanigans with the graveyard that. I think that's a future $10 card. So, yeah.
From Tempest. There you have it. You have a wide range of stuff to digest. Nathaniel, thanks so much for joining us. I think it's been a really great second part of this cast. I'm really happy we got to talk more in depth about some things that, you know, again, I'm sure we can still talk for hours and hours on end, but have to cut at some point. Thank you guys for coming back.
I appreciate you guys having me back, and yeah, I mean, I definitely personally enjoy the other conversations you have with other vendors and dealers. So I hope you guys find enough support to keep that up.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think everyone, especially the listeners, have told us that they really enjoy when we have vendors on. So really, again, appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
And if you haven't, you should use Isle of Cards, everybody. I think a good chunk of QS goers actually really use Isle of Cards a lot. I know that they do. So if you know Nathaniel, definitely use Card Hoarder and Isle of Cards. They're great. They're a great place to use for both MTGO and paper. I can't express it enough. So really, really thank you again, Nathaniel. And keep doing what you're doing. I think you will continue to impress us.
Well, I hope so. And I do want to reiterate, if anybody has any suggestions, I know Tarkin, like way early on, you and I exchanged some emails in terms of some of your suggestions. And, you know, since I'm not from the paper world, you know, I certainly have a different perspective, but I appreciate suggestions and stuff. And like I said, because our site is custom, we can, in theory, of course, put any sort of functionality into our site that would be beneficial. So if people have ideas or thoughts or something they always wish existed, you know, I'd love to hear about that. So
awesome. So yeah, send in the suggestions. Where can they find you on the internet, Tarkan?
At @the_Tark, T-A-R-K on Twitter. I'm over at the MTG Finance Central Facebook page where I chat with people as an admin and work with QS.
Nathaniel?
For me, at Card Hoarder or at Isle of Cards, I suppose either one is typically me replying an email, Nathaniel@cardhoarder.com or Nathaniel@isleofcards.com. They basically go to the same place, so it doesn't really matter which one you use. And I am on the QS forums every day. I mostly lurk, but you know, you can send me a private message there or something, and I would be happy to have a discussion there as well.
Awesome. Yeah, Twitter is the best place for me, @ChazVMTG. I write for QS, insider articles, spoiler articles, the podcast, and you can also find me on the MTG Goldfish podcast. All right, I think that's going to be a wrap for this week. Again, Nathaniel, thanks so much.
Yeah,
thank you.
We will do this again. Take care, everyone. This is the QS cast signing out.